Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Earthbound video games are back.
Dude, I feel like we've said this for 5 weeks in a row now, which is really exciting because video games are overwhelming right now in a good way.
A ridiculous way. You know that whole thing with like the jealous girlfriend meme or whatever it is? I know that's a very common meme and I should know what it is.
Yes.
The one of like the person looking around and someone else is walking the other way.
Distracted boyfriend meme.
That one. Yeah, whatever it is. That thing. I feel like it's been referred to as both, but it is clearly both.
Yes.
But anyway, I feel like my entire backlog is the one looking at me, looking at Final Fantasy 16's demo that's dropping this afternoon, and I should be playing Diablo 4, I should be playing Dead Space, I should be playing everything else, but I'm not gonna.
God, man, I love Dead Space, but I want you to kill that game. Please kill it for me. Every like week, probably even more frequently than that, you say I should play Dead Space.
I really should.
You're not gonna play Dead Space, man.
I think this I might, though.
Too many games
you
right now.
You said this about Resi 4, and then what did I do? I played it.
Aye, but Resi 4 is better
it is.
Than Dead Space. Mm. So I wanted you to go back to that more because I knew there was a great game underneath there. Yes. We'd have great discussions about it. I, unfortunately, for as much as I love Dead Space and would recommend it, don't think we're gonna be talking about that game in the same way we're gonna be talking about Resi 4 come the end of the year.
That's very true. I mean, I just have that whole thing where I think everybody has this at the minute with the amount of first party or the amount of AAA games rather that are mounting up right now, where it's because I was like, I'll get Diablo 4 because that thing is reviewing extremely well. And I didn't like Diablo 3 very much, but our own Adam Strawn from the main channel was like, this game is incredible. It's my game of the year so far. I've seen a lot of people say that. So I was like, I'll get that, but I can't start another brand new £70 game before I finish at least Resident Evil 4 or Dead Space. So I'm back on Resi 4 and I was like, well, I'll finish Resi 4 and then I'll do Diablo and then I'll do Final Fantasy 16. But by the time Final Fantasy 16 gets here, I'll just have finished Resident Evil 4 and I'll probably not even start Diablo. So I don't even know what this is anymore.
They're huge games as well. Like, even Resi 4, considering it's a third-person survival horror shooter, that took me 20 hours to finish, and I played it for 60 hours because I kept going through it over and over again. I feel like you. I've come off a string of incredibly lengthy games, you know, going from Resi, going to Zelda, playing a bunch of stuff in the middle that were just as long. It feels like a lot of stuff to the point where at the weekend, on Friday night, when I finally finished Tears of the Kingdom, a game I really enjoyed. I was relieved I was going to have a bit of a break, to be honest. I can breathe again because it was game to game to game to game to game, which, you know, is a strange thing to complain about, but I like that I get to reset the palette now and then see what comes next.
That was kind of the thing with Tears, because I feel like a lot of these games, like you said, are massive. They're sort of defaulting to 100 hours. I feel like that's the go-to hour count for AAA games or like sort of more recommendable games, is that you will just put a casual 100 hours into each one of these in a row. And there's also little things like Humanities in there as well. Really nice little PlayStation puzzle-based game. Lego 2K Drive, which I mention a lot. We're not sponsored by it at all. But I've enjoyed my time with that game a lot. I also just got Bat Boy, which is very much a Shovel Knight game on Switch.
this is it, man. Humanity, I also want to play it because apparently that's really good on PSVR 2 as well. You can play it on the PS5 as long as the PSVR 2.
I just can't afford it. I'm going to have to wait until there's more stuff.
Fair enough. What you can afford, though, is Amnesia the Bunker, which I think I'm going to play next. I was so buzzing when I found out that was on Game Pass. Yeah. I've yet to start it, but this weekend, I'm going to play Amnesia the Bunker. Scott Tilford, it's a crisp 4 to 6 hours, I've been told, by the internet.
That'll tell you anything.
Amazing, because what you were saying there, I was actually thinking about the other night. I remember doing a Chatty Faces years ago, where we were talking about the game that we put the most time into.
Okay.
And Fallout 4 felt significant for me because it was the first game I'd ever crossed the 100-hour threshold after 25-plus years of gaming. Now, I feel like I do 100 hours in every single game that I play.
I was going to say that's every other game at this point.
Yeah, I know. Which is just like, I was thinking about that and the time investment that you put in. And I'm gaming more than ever, which is good. Mm. But it's crazy when you look at something like Tears of the Kingdom or even a Jedi Survivor or a Resident Evil 4 and you think, yep, that's going to be weeks of time and there's so much coming out.
The thing I'm kind of looking forward to, things taper off a bit across July. I don't think there's anything massive in July. I'm probably forgetting something.
Not in July. I think August is when it like
August is when it kicks back in because that's Starfield and Sea of Stars and whatever. But I'm thinking that July is going to be like the summer bit where I'll sort of get to actually just relax a bit and mop everything else up. I won't. I'll just play Street Fighter 6. That's my game of the year so far. That's the thing that I'm playing in between everything else. But that game also has a story mode, so I keep getting lost in that. Point being that there's a hell of a lot of games right now. And I tell you what, actually, I'll throw in here. I should also say I've taken antihistamine. The hay fever is sky high. That's why my mind is all over the place. But in terms of video games, I played Lies of P. The Lies of P
you
demo.
Oh, I forgot that was out.
Lies of P demo came out during the Summer Games Fest. And I think people will like it. That's what you call the fans. People. Because it's so nakedly wanting to be a Souls game. It's so just like the UI, the animation, the rolling animation. I think for me, I am burned out on that genre. I think if you really like it, if you're just sort of up for more Souls stuff, regardless of anything, you'll probably click with it. But I sort of played it and went, this is exactly the thing that you're aping, and I'm bored.
That's exactly what I want, man.
I think you might do.
I know. I'm an absolute sucker for Souls clones, even if they are just blatant kind of, we'll take this, aesthetic. We'll take this gameplay mechanic and we'll implement it here in a slightly different way. Mm. I love playing them all. In Lies of P looks like one of the most polished one of those.
Yes.
Because you get a lot of indie efforts that try to ape the style and do it quite well, but they lack, obviously, the production budget of a From Software game with all of these lavish levels and massive length and all of these, cool enemy variations. But Liza P kind of looks like it has that,
interesting. The best thing about it, like you said, it's sort of this like, the thing that we'll get onto conference stuff in a bit, like Summer Games Fest, Xbox Showcase, whatever. I feel like there is this rising tide at the minute that has raised all ships where even various games that you've not even heard of the developers for are putting out things that can contend with the AAAs or at least can be mentioned in the same breath of them. Liza P looks incredible. And like, that game can easily contend with the Dark Souls, with the Bloodborne, visually at least. And I like all the production that's been put into the cutscenes and the general idea of like reimagining the Pinocchio story, but as this really dark sort of like more like Pan's Labyrinth, more like a Guillermo del Toro type spin on it, which is great. I love all that stuff. I think that stuff is great. And it was just in the way that I was playing it. I was like, I'm fighting the boss the same way. I'm doing the same stuff. They do have one of the single coolest additions, especially if you've like been playing these games for a while, which is a button dedicated to removing your weapon's durability going down.
Oh,
so you
sick.
Specifically just stand there and you shine your blade on your little metal arm and it makes it like sharp again.
Amazing.
And so you're kind of doing that in between every fight to make sure you're always going in with the sharpest blade. But the idea of addressing like, weapon durability or weapon sharpness or whatever, I feel like is something that will speak to a lot. I mean, it was one of the things in the demo that I went, that's cool. I like that you've done that.
Right.
But yeah, just shouting that game out. The demo was available, came out during the Summer Games Fest. And if you have been hankering for Bloodborne on next gen,
I have.
It's not fully that,
okay.
But it looks they're definitely taken from that. There's some areas in it where I was like, this is exactly the same level layout as Bloodborne.
You're
very much connoting that game.
It's funny, man, because that and Lords of the Fallen both are very obviously after the same crown this year, and both of them look at least visually like properly spectacular. I think Lords of the Fallen. Has embraced the From Software aesthetic so much to the point where when I was watching that gameplay reveal a few weeks ago with my partner, she was like, this literally looks like all of the different areas from Dark Souls 3 and Bloodborne meshed together. To someone on the outside not following it, it can easily be mistaken for it. But, as someone who tries to play as many of these Soulsborne games and their inspirations as possible, or not inspirations, imitators, I suppose, to use a derogatory term, I suppose. I can't get enough. So,
well, the thing is, with the original Lords of the Fallen, that was what worked in its favor, because I remember really liking that game because we hadn't had a next-gen Souls game yet, and I liked the idea of just, it was Lords of the Fallen on PS4, and I thought at the time it moved really well, and I liked all the XP systems and everything. But yeah, Liza P is solid. I just, for me, it didn't carve its own like niche out, other than in terms of the story and I guess the little bits of the presentation, but mostly it was so Soulsy. Let's talk about summer games first, because I feel like overall, and we'll get onto Xbox stuff in a bit, there's such a wider conversation going on as to like what people want from showcases, what the general reception was to each one. Obviously the PlayStation showcase was pretty much hated. Me and you liked it. You can watch our reaction to it over on the channel. We at the time thought there were a good, I mean still do, thought there was a good selection of games on there. And I get the conversation around, you know, CG like over gameplay at the time for the PlayStation one, how that kind of sucked. I wasn't really thinking of it in that way at the time. I was just excited to see the games that were there. But I feel like through Summer Games Fest, and especially Xbox, especially because on the Xbox side you had Aaron Greenberg just saying, we're only going to do gameplay stuff and first party. And you know, we're not going to show any movie trailers, all these little jabs at Sony.
Right, yeah.
And we'll get to that in a bit. But Summer Games Fest is the one that's kind of sitting in the middle. It's either some people's favorite, like it is with me, or it's the one that didn't land. And it was a bit like the PlayStation Showcase, where it was just like, it just nothing really like blew people away.
Yeah, with the Summer Game Fest one, It was funny, man, because after Sony, which I really liked, I thought something like Summer Games Fest, which was so overtly gameplay focused and kind of has that classic E3 theatricality, because you've got Jeff Keighley all the way through hosting it.
Live audience,
you're bringing people on, developers, publishers, and you're talking to them about the games. Like, I love that stuff.
Same, yeah.
And for me, Summer Games Fest as a show, as a produced show, was spot on. It gave me that E3 feeling, you know, it scratched that itch. I thought the way it was constructed, the way it was paced was really well done. It's just that I have some gripes about it that are, I think, legitimate gripes. Yeah. I also have some gripes about it from a purely subjective, personal taste perspective, where, unfortunately for that show, from a pure my taste perspective, none of the games were just my thing, which is a shame, apart from the ones we already knew about. Yeah. So if you permit me, Scott Telford, I want to jump into some of my gripes for this show, because my main issue with the Summer Games Fest is that its best games were stuff that we already knew about. Mm. It didn't have those kind of big reveals for me. It was just kind of
Persia, baby.
Wow, okay.
We'll get back around to it.
There obviously were a few, but the big takeaways from me were Alan Wake 2, were Mortal Kombat, even stuff like Lies of P. They've been announced, we've seen before. Yeah, and what sums up the show to me is when Jeff got Nick Cage out, which as a moment is meme-worthy, is amazing. You're getting caught up in the hype of this movie star that everyone loves coming out on stage. But it didn't work for me because it didn't have the heart and soul that the Keanu reveal did at Cyberpunk, in that, you know, Nick Cage was there, great, but it was for a game that's really old, not great. It's for a crossover that had already been announced a few weeks ago. We already knew Nick Cage was going to be in the game, so it's like you're not really revealing anything new.
Plus, he's just like a skin. Like, and it's not like he's like a, because when they showed the gameplay, it actually looked pretty terrible.
That's
like,
it, right? Yeah. And he's just kind of a skin. It's a content pack. It's not like a single player thing. He's not going to be like a main character. It's like this nice thing, but it's not Keanu coming out announcing, one, that he's in the game and is playing a main role, and two, showing us more footage about a game we wanted to see. To me, it was just indicative of this show being like all kind of frills and all kind of set dressing, but like the content for me just wasn't quite there. It didn't quite justify that level of grandeur that was given it.
Oh, see, for me with Summer Games Fest, like it was, like I said before, it was that idea of like some of the indies, some of the smaller teams like stepping up. And there's one game that I keep mentioning called Banishers, Ghosts of New Eden. It's the next game from the Vampyr devs, Don't Nod. And I was so pleasantly surprised by Vampyr that I love them doing something that looked like it plays like God of War and it all plays like Evil West. I feel like God of War is like low-key becoming a big genre influencer in terms of its third-person action, even though it is in itself Last of Us with a heavier melee combat.
Right.
To be super like reductive about it, that's what it reminds me of, because it is the Sony formula given the melee combat. But yeah, seeing them step up and just sort of like be able to have something that, again, like for me, can contend visually with everything else, and it is a new IP and it does have more to it. I love the look of that thing. Things like Under the Waves as well, and Sandland. I mean, I was blown away by all this stuff. So like, Sandland obviously is massively Akira Toriyama meets meets Mad Max, Under the Waves as well. I forget the name of the devs that are putting that together, but just that idea of new IP, new ideas, new gameplay mechanics. Like in the Xbox One, there was that game that was all about climbing called Jusant, and it's like little things like that where, for me, I've been so, and I hop on about this all the time for new gameplay ideas and new IP, that I was just so glad to see new IP.
Right.
And there were old things in there, things that we knew that had been there before, like Mortal Kombat or whatever, but for me, it was like fresh takes on stuff. Like Prince of Persia, The Lost Kingdom, or Lost Crown, I think looks effing awesome for me. I was blown away by that thing. And when they revealed it was Prince of Persia, I popped massive. Because I love Prince of Persia. Well, I didn't even think of that. I did. Yep. I popped. That's what they should call the marketing campaign. There was a new Sonic in there as well. Like, whatever. Like, the established stuff for me hit big. And then the fact that they like bolstered that with all of these fresh IPs or fresh ideas,
right,
I really liked. But it's not going to be for everyone. Something like Sandland, like, I just think that's gonna, that people would bounce off that if you're not super up for like the Dragon Ball artist takes on Mad Max.
Yeah, I think that's it, man. Like Under the Waves was the one thing from the Summer Game Fest that we didn't already know about that really got me intrigued. That is very much my thing, and I'm gonna be following that until it launches. Mm-hmm. Just for me, while I normally, when we watch a showcase, when I watched the Sony showcase and when I watched the Microsoft showcase, there were a lot of games there that weren't my thing, but I at least could appreciate them for what they were. And I feel like, you know, my taste isn't that limited. I never go into a show wanting one thing specifically. You know, I like to be wowed at stuff that I didn't know I wanted, which I got a lot of in the Microsoft conference. But from a pure taste level, the Summer Games Fest output just didn't have much there that it excited me, even for other people almost. You know, a lot of the new IPs that were there, it's of course cool to see new IP. But I mean, I've talked about this to you so much over in the days since that show, but so much of it felt like just, it's another fantasy game. It's another sci-fi fantasy game set in a barren plain or a barren desert, and we're kind of doing very similar things. Aesthetically, I thought a lot of them looked quite similar, and that was kind of a little bit frustrating for me because Under the Waves was so special because it was the only one in that showcase, again, apart from your Mortal Kombat and Alan Wake's, the new stuff that kind of like looked a little bit different, so it instantly kind of got my attention.
Yeah, for me, there's like this wider conversation on like what mindset should you, not that this isn't for you, I just mean as a wider conversation, because talking to other people who have watched the showcase, the reason that they were like more disappointed is because they did want something specific, and I know you don't go in that way, but I think a lot of people do, and I definitely used to as well. It's like looking for this specific leak or looking for this specific reveal, and when you don't get that, it's like, it was a waste of time.
Right.
And like, I just, for me, I'm like, that's just a wider talking point. And like, in terms of the more of these showcases that we get, the more that they are like publisher specific now, like whether that be the console manufacturers, or like, you know, we've got the Capcom one, there was the Devolver one, Ubisoft is coming up soon. There's like a Ryoga Kotoku one for the Like a Dragon devs. Like, the more of these that we get, like, to me, that needs to be like a change in how we approach them. And just like, I'm not saying you just be happy about everything, but like, I'm just curious how people in general view them. If it's like, are you going in going, well, I hope this specific thing is here, or not? And is that going to change? Because like, this is one of the first years where it's a really strong summer showcase overall, but not if you're going in for specific stuff.
Yes.
Because there wasn't a Naughty Dog reveal at Sony, and there wasn't a Gears 6 at Microsoft or Xbox. And Keighley's ending thing was Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which I thought he absolutely bungled, like just absolutely dropped the ball and shat on it for the most part. Because it was just that whole thing where he's like, at the beginning of the show, it was like, oh, well, we have this incredible reveal, you're not going to want to miss it.
Yeah.
And he's going to have to talk like that because it makes sense. But then at the end, when it was all like really dragging it out and really the rumors were true.
Yeah,
and I was like,
yeah.
Is this going to be the Final Fantasy 9 remake?
That's what I thought. Thought it was.
Because he teased Final Fantasy earlier and then it was a burrito. So like, whatever. And then at the end, it was Final Fantasy 7 Rebirth, which it's not that it doesn't look great and there's a ton of gameplay there and it's a big payoff to how the open world's going to look in 7. But it wasn't that like hair blown back, didn't expect this, oh my God thing, which is in motion because of years of E3 and because of years of expectation. And it's like, does there need to be a fundamental change of the expectation, or is it the fault, quote unquote, or is it the job of someone like Keighley to know what he should end on?
Yeah,
Phil Spencer bungled his as well at the end of the Xbox thing.
True.
Not that Starfield doesn't look great, but saying there's one more thing and then it's something you've already talked about is pretty flat.
I think it's establishing the level of expectation going into it. I remember when Summer Game Fest, the show, first started and I had no expectations because, you know, we didn't know if it was going to be an E3 competitor. We just knew it was going to be an extra showcase and I was kind of pleased to get whatever I wanted. But now that But now that E3 has gone away and now that the hype for Summer Game Fest, you know, naturally because of course Jeff and Cole want to sell this show, they want people watching it. It kind of goes through the roof, but I just wonder if the pull to get those big reveals just isn't quite there yet. I'm sure it will eventually become this huge thing where publishers are wanting to debut the biggest games on that stage, but right there it just doesn't seem quite like that. So we get these situations where you are hyping up something like Final Fantasy VII, which people do want to see, but it's not ending the show on a kind of huge bombshell like even, like you said, you know, another Final Fantasy remake perhaps would. And that's kind of where I think it's a little bit of a shame, because at one point I'm buying into the hype and I'm not quite getting the payoff for that. To me, the Final Fantasy VII thing was just indicative of the show as a whole, where it's like, if you're wanting updates on games that are already announced, you're probably going to have a great time. But for me to end on that, it's like that could have been its own trailer. That could have been in between a bunch of other stuff at the Sony conference as an ender. I just, I want something a little bit more substantial.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it is just like a weird tempered expectation thing. And like, should the expectations be accepted as being lowered because it's not an E3 and there used to be so much money put behind this individual event, and there was an in-baked assumption of competition that just isn't there anymore, and because all these different companies were competing with each other, but now they're just in separate streams. I quite like the way that, I mean, it's in the Xbox thing, but I like the idea of the way Ubisoft approached it with their Star Wars game, where it's like, here's a little teaser and then come watch this thing for more. I like the idea of that for Starfield as well. It's like, we'll flesh it out later.
Well, unfortunately, the best thing in the Summer Games Fest lineup, again, for me personally, this is not me saying it's a bad show or anything, just from a pure taste perspective, was the little snippet we got from the Annapurna publishers sizzle reel about what they were going to reveal. Mm-hmm. Like, I was so bummed that we didn't get more information from this showcase and that we kind of had to wait for their own. Mm-hmm. Because for me, the best part of Summer Games Fest's conference was an advert for someone else's conference. And that's like, on the one hand, it's cool that you get those little teasers, but also I'm like, oh man, if those games were in there, or Annapurna had a bigger presence in the SGF conference itself, I think I'd have been way more hot in it, because then it's like, oh, there's something I'm interested in. That's something a little bit different. It feels like a big pull. But when it's just an advert for their own thing, it's like, oh, maybe could you not get them fully? Or partnership? I don't know.
That's that weird thing of, like, from the publisher's point of view, they must be thinking, well, what do we need this for? What are we actually going to use this for? Because the reason that the ASA lost everybody for E3 was because of how much they were charging to be part of it, when there is the viability to do your own separate stream. So I wonder how penny pinchy or whatever the various publishers are, where they're just like, well, we can just use this as an advert, and then we'll pocket all the streaming money or whatever when you watch our show. Or is that better because we can curate the message differently and we don't have to worry about getting lost in the media coverage of, like, a wider event? Like, maybe that just benefits them to be separate. I think that's a whole interesting, like, side of it as well, because we are, like, right on this nexus of, like, E3 died just before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it was dying. It was pretty much dead. And then now it is dead. It's, like, had a couple of years off or whatever, and this is the new normal for what the summer gaming season is. And some people are calling it, like, Key 3 or whatever. And, like, there's that little sort of, like, attempt of, like, because everyone loves summer game reveals. We've had them in the industry for decades, so why not have something there? But I think that it is kind of being pulled in a few different directions because you have so many different, like, whims that want the most out of it and how it benefits different publishers.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's just, like you said, people dropped out of E3 because they realized they didn't need it anymore. Yeah. And even around Summer Games Fest, if you look at Summer Games Fest as a kind of season rather than as a show, you know, everyone's got their own conference. Sony's got their own conference. Ubisoft's got their own conference. Annapurna's got their own conference. Capcom's got their own conference. You know what I mean? Like, it makes sense for them to want to keep their stuff mostly for their own showcases rather than give it out, because like you said, the world's changed, and in their mind they're probably like, well, what's the benefit? We would rather use it to tease our own stuff rather than give it, quote unquote, there it is again, to someone else.
If we ever release a wind-up t-shirt, it'll just say quote unquote, because that is our go-to. But yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like, you're hopefully putting a trailer out in amongst everybody else because you want to dominate that showcase, and then you get to be in all the headlines with the wider search traffic of that showcase, but you could also be buried amongst everybody else that I was trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So it can kind of go back and forward. Speaking of going back and forward, let's talk about Prince of Persia. That reveal, you did a little gun hands.
I did. I don't know why. Okay. I just got quite excited That was one of the most exciting parts of the show. When that first was revealed, first in the entire showcase, I thought, we're onto a winner here, boys. They've got some big guns.
My mind did about four different things, because I was like, well, we know that the Prince of Persia remake has largely been canned. It's been, like, soft rebooted or whatever. The initial version of it got completely canned.
Yeah.
And then it's still being put out. But, like, obviously the marketing rollout of remake equals new installment hasn't happened. Like, that's usually what happens in the industry, like with Crash or whatever. And then because I was like, well, I'm sure sure this thing is dead. This can't be, they can't have put this together in a few months. And then it started showing the side-scrolling stuff. And I was like, well, okay, this must be something else entirely.
Yeah.
And I was like, it looks so much like Prince of Persia, but then the main dude doesn't look like he's Persian from like visuals. So I was like, I wonder who this dude is. I like the look of everything. And the movement was absolutely phenomenal. I was like, this looks too good to be Prince of Persia. This looks too good to be an Ubisoft game. They've never had something this kinetic ever.
I like this so, looks too good to be an Ubisoft
literally,
game.
I was like, this is the most, if this is Ubi, like me thinking as it was unfolding, I was like, this is the most polished an Ubisoft game has been like earlier in development in years. Like, when was the last time you saw something that completely wowed you from an Ubisoft studio? And so when it finally revealed that it was Prince of Persia, I was like, oh my God, thank you. Like, that's awesome. I love the idea that this dude is the prince. I love the idea that this is like what they're doing for the gameplay. And I was completely sold on it. But obviously there's a lot of dislikes as well.
Right. Well, I know. I was laughing so much at like the people who were saying like, this isn't what Prince of Persia is. And I'm like, my guy, you go back far enough. Like, it started in this way. This is more faithful to its roots, arguably, than kind of like those 3D games that came afterwards.
Well, I was going to say the original games, not the original Prince
of Persia. No, 100%. Yeah. And while it's not necessarily for me, this game, this was one of the ones where I was like, I like that this is here. I like that this is being made. When I found out, especially, that it was the people behind the great Rayman recent platforming games, I thought, absolutely, those were smooth as butter. They played incredibly well. And while the kind of art style itself wasn't for me, I'm going to use a phrase I think you might dislike, but it's almost Fortnite-esque in its...
Isn't everything.
In its presentation and aesthetic, I thought, like, the gameplay, like you said, looked really solid and is like the best version of that concept almost.
Yeah. I think the whole Fortnite thing is fascinating because it's not that I disagree with it. I just think it's become the Dark Souls of X insert. It just sort of is what people say when anything isn't a maturely designed game. Anything with nice refined animation is Fortnite-esque. And it's not that it's untrue in this case. This reminded me more of Immortals Phoenix Rising, which in itself was quite Fortnite-y anyway.
Right.
But I guess we'll wait and see. I like the idea of them investing in Prince of Persia again and doing something with that IP. But yeah, like you said, that whole idea of rebooting the prince, I did like a whole tweet where I was like, this is to 2023 what Warrior Within was to 2004.
Right.
Like, okay. Because 2004's Prince of Persia was that weird reboot for Warrior Within where Godsmack's I Stand Alone was on the soundtrack. Every time the Dahaka arrived, it would kick in and everything. That was like a new metal, heavy metal prince because that's what was in at the time. So like, I don't mind them doing a pop culture reboot of the character. They've done that before. And they tried it again after Two Thrones as well. So it's like, there's a way to do this that the gameplay should shine through. Jules was saying that like it's the time mechanics that weren't present, which I totally agree with. Obviously there's more that can be done there, and there was another cancelled version of Prince of Persia from a few years ago that we didn't get that had more time incentivized stuff. So I guess we'll see. What did you think of Mortal Kombat 1/12?
That was, man, I'm going to sound like so negative, and I don't want to be. It's just like, it looked like Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's cool. But I popped much more at the CG trailer, funnily enough, than I did from the gameplay, because it's not like the gameplay looked bad. It looked incredible. It looked solid. It just looked like a natural evolution of Mortal Kombat 11, which is fine. That game played like incredibly well. Mm. But I was like, yep, this is what I imagined the next Mortal Kombat would be.
Yeah, I had a weird thing where I was like, because obviously they built it up so much. Ed Boon and Jeff Keighley were both tweeting loads, oh, come see the Summer Games Fest. Oh my God, they've got all these reveals. It'll blow your mind, et cetera, et cetera. And we're always curious what the new cameo system is. That's the thing that I really don't like right now, and I hope that I change on it going forward. I don't like fundamentally assist-based fighters. I like the idea of one-on-one combat. Like, I'm a UFC fan. Like, I want to watch bouts. I want to watch one-on-ones.
Right.
I'm not bothered about... This is a stupid reason, potentially, but it breaks my head canon. Like, why is Sub-Zero standing with his nemesis? Why is... none of that... And it's so, like, thrown together. And I don't know. It has a lot of opportunities for shenanigans. And I know that over on Jeff Gerstmann's channel, X like Giant Bomb Jeff Gerstmann, he had just raw gameplay of playing it, and Jax's fatality from MK2 is in there,
yeah,
where he randomly just becomes a giant and steps on someone,
right?
And so I was like, okay, so we're just doing stuff now, and I'm like, I can totally go with that. MK has always just done stuff, but I think because they're relying on the assist mechanics quite a lot for combo extenders and for launches and things like that. I mean, there's a lot more going on with launches in general. But yeah, there's something about just throwing anybody in there. And there's already rumors of like Megan Fox being in there,
yeah,
and like Jean-Claude Van Damme's going to be in there, which makes sense for Johnny Cage. But how wide are they going to go? How Warner Brothers are they going to get with the microtransactions?
Yes.
Like, so weirdly thrown in. How Fortnite-esque, ironically,
are
they going to get with how many different brand deals they can do? And then will the extra characters that we get be cameos? And they, I don't know. Like I said, an assist-based fighter does very little for me.
Interesting that, especially the thing about it potentially breaking like the immersion in your brain because you're like, why are these characters
I want, because those, to me, Mortal Kombat's roster is one of the coolest rosters of anything ever made.
Like, I agree.
Some of the greatest character designs ever. I want them to take center stage. And every time I watch this footage, when I watch the victory animation, it's always shared because it has to be two people on screen every time. And I love MK11's victory animations because they're all slick as hell. And so I don't need this weird, and they're not even like doing a tag victory animation because those two characters haven't had anything made where they interact with each other. It might be somewhere it's like that.
Right.
But the ones that I was watching was like Sub-Zero with Kano, and they're both just doing separate victory animations, but they might as well be green screen together. Like,
right,
they're not actually together. It's just a weird disconnect for me.
That's
in terms of like what it feels like to play as those characters.
I would never have thought about that. This is why I love doing podcasts with you. That's not something that
I might have just broke that for everybody watching now.
Literally did not even enter my brain. Like, to me, as much as I love the Mortal Kombat lore, they've always been silly arcade fighters.
Yes.
That's why I like jumping into them outside of the story mode, of course, which we will be interesting to see how they implement the cameo moveset in the actual story mode. But when I'm just like, you know, playing the arcade modes, or I'm just jumping into training or whatever, like, I want to get as silly as possible with it. So I want to get RoboCop in there. I want to get Megan Fox in there. I want to do all this
stuff.
John Rambo in there. And I like that. And I think at least with this game, from the fatalities that you mentioned there, from the cameo fighters, from the aesthetics of the characters, I really do like what they're doing with the timeline shenanigans and how they're remixing things. I like that Scorpion and Sub-Zero are brothers now.
I don't know what I think about that.
Well, is that not interesting? Because how many times recently have we got a Mortal Kombat game where we've been like, this seems like a bold creative swing in terms of the story and what we know of the mythology? Like, obviously, they've done bold things. They made Liu Kang a fire god at the end of the last game. But in terms of remixing and really playing with our expectations, I'd suppose.
Well, my thing is just like, because you had them be age-old enemies for like three decades, and then they finally settled their differences in MK10 and were actively buddy-copping it up in MK11, which I loved, they'd overcome so much and started working together. So when you've actually then kill off that version of Scorpion and reset him to the original version, but then you rewrite the rules of the entire timeline anyway, that like character growth, let's say, or that arc that they went on doesn't exist anymore.
No.
But they are now just as close because their brothers, so it kind of felt like a weird, we've wrought ourselves into a corner, we've wrought ourselves in a certain direction, but we actually want to keep them being close, so we'll just make them brothers. And it's just like, for me it's just hardcore stupid fanboy stuff.
Yeah,
but I was just like, I liked it more when they overcame their differences and chose to work together as opposed to writing it that way. But yeah, I guess I'm curious. I like what they're, in theory, what they're doing with Raiden, where he gave all of his powers to Liu Kang, but he still is demonstrating lightning stuff in the fights anyway. So I'm curious about that whole world, because it, biome wise it's like old school feudal Japan next to like technologically advanced, almost San Francisco in like looking tech stuff. Then it's the way that like God of War's world works, where you can walk from one ancient mythology to another. And I assume that Liu Kang has just built this world that is multiple timelines, multiple time periods all together, and you can just walk from like San Fran to old school Japan. Like, that's kind of cool, I guess.
It rhymes. Like, it is cool. Hey, I enjoy that stuff. Like, I like that, you know, Raiden's character model seems so much younger than we've ever seen him before. For instance, I like that, talking about the different locations there, I like that you can have this kind of classic MK jungle setting existing side by side with what looked like Johnny Cage's mountainside apartment, like this slick modern flat essentially. I thought that was...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Really cool and something I haven't personally seen in a Mortal Kombat game for at least a long, long time.
Yeah.
Those changes in the aesthetic are neat to me. I was more focused on those and more interested in those than I was the actual fighting mechanics because they, like I said, looked like such a natural continuation of what was established in MK11. More so, I think anyway, and I haven't played these games in a while, than the jump from MK9 to MK10 to MK11. Those leaps, at least from this early stage, seemed much more substantial in terms of mechanics and feel than what I'm getting from MK11 to 12.
I would massively back that. I wonder how much that comes from like the insider stuff saying that they were initially going to be working on Injustice 3 and then things were like shuffled around internally and they had to do MK12/1 instead. And maybe that scuppered the R&D part of development where it's like, okay, what the hell do we do with this next?
Yeah.
Let's just do a lot more of the cameo stuff, because the cameo fight is just to sort of like, you know, reinforce why I'm skeptical of all of it. They were some of the worst parts of MK11. Like that whole idea of like you were getting all these different tokens and unlocks so you could trigger a character to leap in and finish a combo for you. They were fun and it was their way of like tapping into the wider like MK character roster.
Yeah.
But that was also the stuff that was wrapped up in all the microtransaction side of it as well. I just can't help but see that as one of the, it was fine once they balanced it out, but like it wasn't, like, I didn't feel like the MK fandom was clamoring for the entire game to be built around that portion of MK11. And I have to assume that in MK1, I want to just call it MK12 because it's the 12th main installment. I assume that they'll still have lots of one-on-one bouts. As far as I know, they haven't shown any yet, and maybe they have somewhere. But I'm just a little bit skeptical of the most Warner Brothers-y microtransaction-y parts of MK11 now taking center stage because it was a publisher decision to remix their release schedule anyway. So it's kind of just, I don't know, I'm just hedging my bets. I love MK. It's in my top three franchises of all time.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be like super scrutinous of it. So it's just that.
Hey man, like this is Warner Brothers, you know, you mentioned it there. Like this game absolutely will have some shenanigans at launch. Like Warner Brothers are going to see what they can get away with in terms of microtransactions and selling you stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know necessarily what form that's going to take right now. But to me, the fact that they're already selling Shang Tsung separately as a pre-order bonus, I think, is just like, come on, guys. Like, why do this? You always have great games. The developers are making great games. The publisher is always saying, well, what if we can sell those great games for more?
Well, the thing is, and I said this when it got revealed, is this not the only positively received fan-endorsed thing that Warner Brothers has right now, especially in gaming? Something that is largely uncontested when people go, oh my god, Mortal Kombat. It's not like you have that wing of the internet going like, ah, actually, it sucks now.
Yeah.
Everyone loves MK. So it's like, they're like, how much can we get away with, like you said?
Honestly, probably across all of the mediums they dabble in, because I don't know anything like film-related that they have knocked it out the park with recently. No. I know they've recently renamed HBO Max to just Max, and there's a lot of shenanigans going on with the content on that platform. They're having a mare of a time, and MK is like the one thing that's been consistently good for them. So yeah, maybe they're doing exactly what you mentioned.
And also
there.
Like, you know, they have Suicide Squad got pushed back a whole year.
Yes,
so I can't not imagine some sort of finger interlocking business person just saying like, well, we can monetize the hell out of that thing and make up the difference that we have because we've messed everything else up.
Well, I don't think this is, you know, just judging them on their current form either, because you look at Mortal Kombat 11 and the state that launched in with all of the stuff they try to get away with and how much they had to patch out of that game. And it's like they do this every time. They do it every time. Yeah. And I'm not surprised by it anymore. And it's more a matter of when does the backlash start rather than is there going to be some backlash to some of the practices in the game.
And I'd say one of the worst examples, just to throw it in, was Shadow of War, trying to over monetize the love of Shadow of Mordor and then killing that game. And you remove all the microtransaction storefront from it, but that was like 8 months after launch, and that franchise never ever recovered.
I'll never forgive them for patenting the Nemesis system until like 2035 or whenever it is, and then having the audacity to kill the franchise that was in. It's like, okay, we're going to not do it any justice, but also no one else can use it. Great, thank you.
I assume that'll be in the Wonder Woman game, because there was like this weird leak that she'll use the Lasso of Truth to turn people to her side, and it'll all be about building armies and stuff. And I was like, okay, if you're doing something with it, that's cool. But also, Shadow of Mordor will be 10 years old next year.
Don't say that to me.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Battleshock Infinite is 10 years old this year.
Bloody hell.
So is Last of Us, and GTA 5, but... not to worry. I think in terms of overall with Summer Games Fest, like you said at the very beginning, the way that Jeff Keighley approached it did feel like something more E3 adjacent, with the live audience and with like the celebrity cameos and like that kind of thing. For me, I really, really liked that stuff.
You know, like I say, it was a great show in terms of its production. I'm excited to watch it next year. I think Jeff really has something special with the format and his presence and the way that the games are showed and how it showcases developers. It's just, for me, it is the content. It's like, what is the content you're delivering? And unfortunately, like I keep saying, from a pure personal taste perspective, the content isn't there to justify how nailed down everything else is. Like, gameplay focused presentations, amazing. The stage show, the theatrics, amazing. Just get the games.
I know what you mean. Josh Brown, let's talk about the Xbox showcase. That was a big old deal.
That was a big old deal. And you know what, Scott Tilford? Bloody loved it, I did. Really, really liked it.
I feel like overall, and we mentioned this earlier in this podcast, the rollout of the different showcases, PlayStation's was pretty much despised. Summer Games Fest, bit of a mix. And so far with Xbox, it's massively positive. A few people in there sort of...
Is that right?
Well, I think so. What I've seen is mostly positive.
Oh, I mean, I'm genuinely asking you there, because I've not been keeping up with it. I heard that the PlayStation fallout, like you said, was not great, and now going into Xbox, I actually haven't put my little feelers out to see what the reception is. So that's really exciting.
So far, so good. I feel like a lot of people were initially blown away by Fable. Obviously, it was maxed out in terms of just seeing gameplay. What's the future of Xbox? Do they have something to get excited about? Starfield, thankfully, coming together. Cross all the fingers. Pray to all the gods. It seems like it'll be extremely solid. But general thoughts on this, and then we'll run some stuff down.
Loved it, man. Yeah. I really did. Like, I think they started strong with the first three games that they announced, and they kind of just kept the ball rolling for me. I love a conference. I said this earlier, that gives me what I want alongside what I didn't know I needed, and this kind of had that for me. I know some people were maybe complaining a little bit that there wasn't as much gameplay as promised, perhaps, but all of the CG trailers that I saw looked really interesting. There was, of course, stuff that I didn't care about in lulls in the show, like when they were talking about Fallout 76 and the Elder Scrolls Online and Sea of Thieves updates. Even though they look quite good, it's just like, okay, those are established franchises. Of course, they're going to be there. They're Microsoft owned. But it was the world premieres, Microsoft loves to say, and how much was on Game Pass day one that I really enjoyed.
I think the thing, as a wider thing, again, before we get to like specific game stuff, the thing that it made me think of is the future that both companies are planning for. If you compare what PlayStation's planning for and what Xbox are planning for, PlayStation seems to be the twin prong approach. It's either massive AAA games in the vein of something like A Last of Us or whatever, with a massive production budget. There's a whole thing doing the rounds at the minute that internally they demand 90 on Metacritic, which obviously invokes a certain level of polish or graphical style or whatever it is. we'll see how those games will shake out. And a live service future. They've invested a lot in Foam Stars and Fair Games and the various tech around that, and getting Bungie to analyze them and whatever. And Matter will... No, yeah,
Matterfall?
No, no, the other one. The Marathon.
Marathon.
The reboot of Marathon will be in that vein as well. And that seems to be Sony's whole thing. Big AAAs and also live service stuff. Xbox's thing, and you saw the worst of it with Redfall, is letting the devs do whatever, quote-unquote, whatever they want, like in a wider sense, in a bigger variety of gameplay mechanics, art styles, whatever, and then it's all financed by Game Pass. And because they have a certain amount of people on Game Pass, they can afford to free up the creative risk side of it, and they don't need to demand the 90 on Metacritic. They can do stuff that is just a really good 7 or an 8 out of 10, or whatever. And I, overall, and well, this is just right now, we have no idea how it's going to pan out across the next, let's say, the rest of the generation, or going forward, I massively prefer Xbox's approach. I'm only talking about approaches, though. So we'll see how it goes.
That's it, because the proof is in the pudding, right? Because for as hyped as I was from Xbox's showcase, their recent track record, Scott Tilford, is not great.
Like,
you mentioned Redfall there, obviously Halo Infinite before that. They have, of course, made big AAA games that I love. I'm a big fan of the new Gears. Gears 5 especially is my jam. But for as promising as all this is, I'm hesitant to fully back them because they are yet to fully deliver something on the level of Sony, for me, at least right now.
Yes.
But that said, I think they had a better conference than Sony. I thought the games were more interesting. And man, we always say it, but Game Pass is the best deal in gaming.
By far.
And what's so great about Game Pass is that if you have it, it makes the games in showcases like this that you might not necessarily be attracted to initially more appealing, because you know you're going to be able to play them without that financial risk, without I get to see something that might not be what I like on paper, but looks a little bit interesting. And rather than saying, oh, I might get to that one day and then never getting to it because it still costs money, I get that access point because it's, you know, quote unquote free because I'm paying for this service. I get to try games that I wouldn't otherwise jump into because of that price barrier. And like you said, sometimes that leads to maybe a lack of quality because it's content first over the quality that's going into it. They want people on the service. But I think for conferences anyway, it makes it more exciting because, you know, I'm not necessarily a hardcore racing guy, but I'm going to play a Forza because it is free on Game Pass. It is day one on Game Pass.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you've already paid for it anyway, so you might as well. And I think that obviously right now Xbox literally are in catch-up, and I'm only talking hypotheticals. I'm only talking about a potential future where Sony's live service stuff is established and all their games feel the same. Because we've already many times identified the Sony formula, the over-shoulder camera, the light crafting mechanics, the semi-open world, whatever. There are things that point in that direction. It point at them being the next Ubisoft, and then you get that tired and do something else. So that's all I'm talking about is potentials. Obviously, that shines a big old angelic light on the Xbox stuff and hopes for the best, because you could end up with a future of Xbox that is just 20 different Redfalls, where they're not actually monitored that well, and I don't think anyone's going to want that either. But I think overall, they did a good job here of just saying, like, this is what we're doing. This is our approach to the industry. You know, and earlier in the year, we had Hi-Fi Rush that was just Shadow Drop. Nice, solid little game, 7, 8 out of 10, designed to be finished, not designed to have a monthly pass or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a way for me that I think that benefits the player in a way that Sony's live service future wouldn't. And it's not, I totally get Sony shooting their shot because they're way out ahead right now. And that's fine. But I think that in terms of the Xbox showcase, the reason it seems to be that a lot of people are super positive on it is remembering why Xbox used to matter. And it used to be a variety of titles. It was that whole 360 era. And I think there's a lot there that could, it's not going to win them the generation.
No.
But it's very, very strong, especially when they're like, they have like 10% of the market share right now.
I think that's a good point. It was the most 360 feeling showcase they've done in a while. And I've been a fan of Xbox's recent showcases. Like the last two I really enjoyed. I think the 2021s in particular was good, if I am remembering correctly. But here, like you said, you've got those returning franchises. You've got those new IPs that are coming. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, how many years have we spent in this room or a room like it or working from home saying, when are we going to finally see what all of these studios that Microsoft has bought are working on? And I felt like I finally got a glimpse of that here. I didn't get stuff that I might have wanted, like an update on State of Decay 3, Gears 6 or anything like that. But I got to see what In Exile was working on.
Yes.
I got to see more from Avowed. I got to see a bunch of other titles that we're definitely going to talk about. And that was really cool.
Well, my thing with Avowed was, like, I wasn't expecting that game to almost play like Bulletstorm.
Yeah.
Where you're, like, booting dudes across the landscape. And I was like, okay, that's a really cool, more innovative, more immediately playable way to contend with the Bethesdas. You don't even need to contend with them because they're in your wider family, but a way to be distinct. Obsidian forever in the shadow of Bethesda. In terms of the optics of that company, I absolutely love Obsidian.
Me too.
And I'm always wanting them to be recognized on the same level, if not above Bethesda. Which is why we should talk about Avowed, because this is something that, I mean, was mentioned, what, when these Series X was first announced?
Yeah, we got that CG trailer, I think, from back in the day.
It was like a whole thing. And so for me, yeah, the way that the gameplay came across was really solid. And for me, that was just emblematic of the Game Pass idea. I was going to say promise there, but I feel like it's just the idea of it. Because right now, they're out there saying that they're going to be doing four major first-party games every year. They initially said they would have like two, I think it was a few years ago.
Yeah.
They couldn't maintain that. So doubling it and trying to stick to it is a different thing. But overall, like that conversation on in-engine gameplay or gameplay in general, I think is another reason that people were a bit disappointed with. There's some people who were a little bit disappointed with it. I wasn't, because I was like, Fable, it says in-engine. Oh my God, that's a big old well-rendered Richard Iwade doing his thing.
Yeah.
I thought in-engine is like a nice middle ground of the CG stuff from the PlayStation side and something that's maybe like a lesser production budget on the Summer Games Fest side.
Yeah, me too, man, because I mean, even that Fable one, it looked at least that what we were seeing, like you said, it definitely was in-engine, but it might even be a cutscene in the game itself, you know? And then it did feel like we got like a little bit of gameplay towards the end with the character running away from Richard Iwade's giant and stuff. So to me, they struck a nice balance of at least trying to represent what the game's going to look like and not having proper CG trailers where it's like, okay, the game is not going to look anything like this. This is you know, just their visualization of what the game could be and its themes and its atmosphere and all of that stuff. Same with Avowed. Like, I thought Avowed, like, that seemed really gameplay focused of a reveal, which was great after we saw the CG trailer a few years ago. I'm jumping between the two games now, but for me, Avowed looked like great. It looked like how I expected it to, almost the Skyrim-esque fantasy game by Obsidian. But what Obsidian said since has been really appealing. Like, they've said that initially they wanted it to be like a Skyrim killer. It was going to be their big open world fantasy game.
Okay.
Where they've since not scaled it down, but certainly scaled it down in terms of the ground mass that you're covering. It doesn't seem like it's open world anymore. It seems like it's a bunch of different areas, kind of like how Outer Worlds handled it, where it gave you hubs and mini open worlds rather than
like
one
that
big one.
Dead Island 2, baby.
Dead Island 2.
Yeah.
And I like that because, like they said in their post-trailer interview, it means they can focus on depth rather than just the sheer breadth of the game or the sheer scope of the game, so they can go deeper with their choices, which to me is something that Outer Worlds did lack. I loved the polish of that game, but it wasn't up there with New Vegas in terms of the agency you had as a character or the stories that you were involved in. I would prefer a smaller landmass with more interesting stories than a bigger one that's more sparse and more focused on gameplay loops.
Which is a perfect segue into what Bethesda are building. Because Starfield, I think they said it's like 1,000 or 10,000 planets or something. And obviously the go-to with that is to worry about how procedurally generated they are. Is it going to be another No Man's Sky situation? And there's been a lot of conversation around how authored those planets are. And that was one of the biggest things they wanted to nail down. There was a separate Starfield Direct after the Xbox showcase, which we both tapped out of after a while, just because you want to experience some of it when you go in fresh.
That's literally it. It wasn't because I thought it was bad. I thought it was too good.
Yeah.
It was too good. And I wanted to experience, especially like the character customization and your first mission. I want to do that fresh because I'm already sold on it, man. I kind of was a few years ago after the first trailer. It already sounded like something I'd be interested in. And to see them, yesterday, at the time of recording, you know, address the idea of how are they going to address the fact that they have 1,000 planets? How are they going to make it feel curated or interesting? To me, it works on that level because, you know, it's almost so far removed from what Avowed and the Outer Worlds was doing it's like a completely different thing. Like, the pleasure of this game presumably is going to be as much in like exploring these uninhabited planets and just seeing what's out there as much as it is taking on missions and getting better loot. Like, it's that sense of exploration that you get from a game of this scale that I'm looking forward to. And yeah, it might end up sparse, but I mean, I love Mass Effect 1, Scott Telford,
right? Me too.
And I love the planets that you can drop on in that game, even though they are kind of all the same.
With
and there's
one
that
little
variety,
base.
And there's one base on each one. It's just that kind of almost childish wonder that I've been striving for since Mass Effect dropped, and obviously No Man's Sky tapped into it. Now Starfield feels like it's doing it on a bigger budget. Mm-hmm. That I cut it a lot of slack, perhaps wrongly, but it's so up my street that I can't help it.
No, I thought that, like, it's one of those things where I was like, this looks like the most robust Bethesda game they've had in a long time. Looks very, very polished. They've obviously had to take the time to make sure it's like worthy of like an Xbox first party game. Some of the character animations, interactions, some of the dialogue bits, like that's where I was like, yeah, it's still a Bethesda game.
Yeah, it's still
that engine underneath.
Absolutely.
But overall, it is with Bethesda, it was always the scope. It was always the, oh my God, how have they built this much stuff and made it feel authored? Like, for as humongous as Skyrim is or was, it always felt authored. It didn't feel like any part of it was procedurally generated, even if there were parts to the landmass that were like that. And that's the thing that I think will carry it over the top. Like, now they finally, after like 10 years, have a game that you should buy a series system to play.
Yes.
Like, in theory.
Well, this is the proof. It looks good, though. Because, I mean, we can sit here and say, yeah, this footage looks polished, but this is Bethesda we're talking about. When have they released a polished game in their lives? Literally never. You want to hope this is the one.
Yes.
And everything they showed was promising. But yeah, the proof will ultimately be there day one. Because, yes. I mean, Redfall looked polished, and then look how that turned out when it finally released.
Cyberpunk as well. Have a little showcase, a little showing at the showcase where they got Keanu Reeves back out to talk about Phantom Liberty. Now, one massive thing with this game, and it's not Xbox related necessarily, but it's worth flagging, is that Phantom Liberty heralds a complete overhaul of that base game for free. It's almost like this weird, like they're barely talking about it. They're just sort of doing this this DLC add-on that stars Idris Elba, and apparently has just as much content is in it as the main game. But they've also gone back and overhauled the game, added all these different AI systems, added vehicle car chases, overhauled the skill tree, the UI, everything. The graphics model, the graphics in general look way better.
Yeah.
I was watching the video during the Xbox showcase thinking like, this looks so much noticeably better than it did either on the old school versions or the ones that were sort of semi for new gen. And then they had the new gen update as well. But yeah, it's just worth flagging that if, in terms of Cyberpunk stuff, they're doing a lot to it again.
You know what, man? I love and resent this. I love the fact that they're actually sticking with the game and they are constantly committed to improving it and releasing it in the state that it should have been or what they promised way back when. Mm. But as someone like you who played that game at launch on the PlayStation 5, even though there wasn't a PlayStation 5 version then, and suffered through all the bugs and still had quite a nice time, like, I still can't get over the fact that I want to play this version of it. I want to play this polished, optimized, fully updated with features version of it. And I'm simply not going to be like, at this point, with the next gen updates, with the patches, and with this overhaul, they've created like four versions of this game, marginally better. And it's like, come on.
No, I massively agree. Like, that's the thing. It's like, I'm glad to see it, like, in its own little bubble, but, like, you should have had this back in 2020. Like, this should have been the thing that it launched with. That kind of goes without saying at this point, because it is so long in the tooth how fixed it should have been at launch. But, I mean, they already kind of did the next-gen version that was meant to have all these different things in that weren't there at launch. Now, and I forget what the name of the new creative director is, he just keeps mentioning, people complained about this, so we fixed this. People wanted car chases, so we put them in. People wanted better police chases, so we put them in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this isn't what you guys were making anymore. This is just like, how many little ember fires can we put out now that we've done the bigger one?
Yeah, man, honestly, like, Cyberpunk's DLC, I'm all here for. It is just that situation of like the base game. For me, as someone who definitely was burned on that at launch, you know, I feel a bit resentful, perhaps wrongly, perhaps from a petty standpoint. I don't think so necessarily, because I was sold one thing and didn't get it.
Massively.
That I will never get the best version of that game, because even if I play it again, like, you only get one time through a game with that kind of sense of wonder. And I feel like I know what Night City is from its core base. I know what weapons are in there. I know what the missions ultimately play like. And all of this stuff is really nice. But I'd have loved that next-gen version of it. Hopefully, though, I scratched that itch with the DLC itself, which sounds great, hopefully.
Yes.
Again, fingers crossed. Proof is in the pudding. But, you know, it's CD Projekt Red have made great expansions in the past. I loved The Witcher 3, Blood and Wine. And if it's anywhere near that level, it's going to be something that's on my radar. And the fact that it's coming out this year as well is a plus. might finally get me back into this
game.
That
was the thing of like realizing that, yeah, it's been 3 years since Cyberpunk. Like, obviously, they devoted a whole bunch of resources to fixing the version that came out, but now they've just sacked off the last-gen versions, the PS4, the Xbox One, and that stuff's just gone, so they're just making finally making the actual next-gen thing. In amongst all this coverage as well was mention of Cyberpunk 2077 sequel,
yeah.
And we don't know what the hell that thing's going to be called. I think that had been leaked beforehand, mentioned a little bit beforehand in investors' calls and stuff.
They confirmed it last year, Scott.
Right, okay.
Yeah, like, it's fair to kind of let it slip your mind because it was when they announced like the Witcher reboot and like the next Witcher game. It was like that big slate of titles that they announced, and Cyberpunk 2077 2 was in that. But yeah, like, I haven't really mentioned it much since, but because the focus has been on this.
Bringing it up again because when we talk about it, like you said, you talk about how broken the launch was, how split those versions were. Then there was the next gen version that came like a year and a half after, and now there's the actual next gen version that is fundamentally built without any of the previous stuff. That is another overhaul. So it's like, okay, if you haven't played yet, I guess now you should come in, but we've been saying that for the last two versions anyway.
That's true.
I don't know. But yeah, we mentioned a little bit before about gameplay and you know, that difference between in-engine stuff, whether it's satisfying and actual gameplay. A few games did get proper gameplay showcases, like Avowed, but also like Clockwork Revolution, which is in Exile's new game, which I thought was like Bioshock 4 for a while.
It looked
it's
like
very Bioshock.
This was one of my games of the show because In Exile have a great track record, but they've never built something on this scale. Like, they are known when they were bought by Xbox for their isometric RPGs. Like, they were obviously like very indebted to that kind of old school style of game. So to have them hopefully bring the depth that comes with that, you know, subgenre to something more action focused, to a first person shooter, it looks like, that's exciting. I didn't expect to see that at all. And if I saw a new In Exile game, I thought it was going to be like the ones they created before. So this to me was like Microsoft setting themselves up as like the place to be for RPGs. You've got Bethesda.
Oh, yeah.
You've got In Exile. You've got Obsidian, not to mention the other devs that work for you. Like, those are a big three. And from the games that were shown, man, like, it's an RPG guy's dream, you know?
I think as well, like, that idea of like, because Game Pass bolstered every single one of these reveals, like, you can pick one of them and you know that you'll have it for the next few months. Like, you don't have to worry about trading it in for the next thing, which seems to be the go-to at the right now, trying to keep up with every single release. But I think Game Pass solves a lot of that stuff. But yeah, also in here, just in terms of things that have been teased for a while or hasn't been shown for a while, Hellblade 2, which I thought had a bit of a flat showcase this time, considering the first time they showed it. Well, the first time they showed it was when the Series X was confirmed with that really cool facial animation. And then there was the gameplay demo, which looked incredible. And then this one was just a cutscene.
It was.
Could have done a little bit more.
A little bit unexpected, wasn't it? You know, it's nice to see an update on it. Mm-hmm. This is a game, though, that I'm sick of hearing about.
Oh, okay.
Almost. I will play it when it's out, but I mean, it was announced so many years ago. Like you said, it's had these two reveals already, and even now, after last night's showing, I don't feel like I know any more about the game or really what it is. Of course, it looks gorgeous. You know, the original Hellblade did. Of course, the sound design is immersive, just like the original. Of course, the performances look spot on. It's just, I almost need the game itself. It's had such a long tail, and I just kind of want to have it in my hands to know what it is.
I kind of couldn't believe that Melina Jurgens was saying we've just finished recording now.
Yeah,
I know, like,
right?
Hellblade was like 2018. And like, and I know that they had this whole new like way of recording the performances that was like, it was digitizing in real time or something. So I get that. But then I know that Ninja Theory also got out there. I always get the dev. No, it is Ninja Theory for those guys.
It is, yes.
So the team Ninja or Ninja Theory? I'm going to go
Ninja Theory.
They got out there during the pandemic, I think it was, showing like a new Unreal Engine 5 style tech demo where they'd like rendered their own kitchen and it looked incredible. And I was like, you're not doing Hellblade with the, is Senua's kitchen? Is it what we do? And so now that they've said, oh, we finally wrapped Hellblade, I'm like, okay, good, because like that's what I thought you'd already had banked because you were showing other stuff.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, it's beyond time.
I suppose on the plus side or a potential positive, it makes me wonder about the scale of the game. Like, how big is this game going to be if it's been in development for this long? If they're just wrapping up, you know, doing the mocap and finishing off the finalizing the script, the shooting script. That to me is exciting because it's already seems from the trailers that we've seen a much bigger game than the original was. You know, I really enjoyed the original, but the gameplay was a little bit repetitive.
Yeah.
Like the level design,
puzzles suck,
and the puzzles weren't all that great. So this just seems like such a bigger beast, and that is cool. I just I need to see a little bit more because these kind of like drip feed teasers aren't necessarily doing it for me.
I'll tell you what drip feed tease did do it for you. It was Still Wakes the Deep. Yes, that was both of our games of the show, or one of many anyway. The next game from, I think it's the Chinese Room.
The dudes
that did Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. Which, that game, I loved Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. That was like sort of one of those games that is held up as like, you know, it's too arty for its own good. And it is very, very arty. And it kind of disappears up its own bum. But at the same time, I had a lot of fun with that. And I thought it was quite hauntingly, I thought it was really effective, atmospheric, and especially towards the end. Very, very effective in terms of the twists and everything. So I love them sort of doing, why don't we do a really creepy horror set out at sea on like an oil rig or something.
Yeah, man.
That thing seemed very, very promising.
Like you said, you know, also my game of the show. You know, I was a big fan of Everyone's Gone to the Rapture. I thought in terms of atmosphere, that game just nails it. Like walking around that deserted English town and trying to figure out what's going on. Like the sense of place has always been great. Their attention to detail has always been great. So to see that transferred to this, like you said, spooky oil rig in this thunderstorm, you know, rain swept, dark, moody, rusty, like that just was ticking all my boxes in terms of personal taste.
Yeah,
like that. I think I might message you saying that's like a bit of me. If you designed a game for me, it looks like this.
It's always one of those things where I can't, because obviously like feeds load in different amounts of lag, and I was like, we would message you till it went like all caps. Oh my god, this thing! And I was like, okay, which thing? Is it the one that's ending, or did something happen? But yeah, with that one, we were both like, this looks incredible. Just like good Lovecraftian adjacent sea horror is always a good way to go.
Man, and I feel like it's in right now. Like, after having played Dredge, I've got the itch for that kind of stuff. So hopefully it has the narrative to kind of bolster the aesthetics and the visuals and the atmosphere. And I'd hope so from the developers that are on board.
Yeah, yeah. Did anything else stand out to you that you want to mention, or shall we wrap?
There is one that I have forgotten the name of, and this is not because of the game's quality. It's because I'm just bad at remembering names, people, or otherwise. But it was like the second one we saw that was like the person playing the guitar is set in the
South. Oh my god, Compulsion Games?
South of Midnight. Yeah, South of Midnight. I thought, like, again, visually that looked like very much my thing.
Awesome, like, art style. Awesome, like missing every other frame kind of thing?
Yeah,
really
great
sweet.
Great animation style. Again, moody, atmospheric. I want to know more. Like, I don't really know much about Compulsion Games as a dev.
No.
So they're quite new to me. But in terms of making a first impression, I thought it was spawn.
No, man, same. I was one of those ones where, like, I obviously, you know, that whole conversation on does in-engine game play or in-engine game rendering satisfy? It totally did for me, because I can look at that and go, well, the game engine's going to be something similar to that. It's going to play with a level of fidelity that it should match that kind of thing. Also, shout out to does accurate guitar work. Very rare
in video games
where they're actually doing the right chords and doing the right strings and everything. I thought it was really, really cool. But yeah, it's one of those showcases that had a good mix of stuff. Obviously, the first party came out strong. There are still some notable absences, like the future of Gears or whatever, but for overall, they needed this to hit, and they very much did.
This is it. This is the highest praise I can give this showcase, and I forgot to mention it earlier because we kind of went on to Avowed, but I even liked Fable. Fable hated Josh
Fable
Brown.
Rules, man.
Really loved the Fable trailer. Yeah. I thought, in terms of the Britishness of the humor, it was the kind of stuff that I actually like and don't really cringe at. I mean, Richard Ayoade is great. Makes great movies, by the way. He's an incredible director in his like deadpan delivery as that character. Spot on the kind of mockumentary style framing that they had. Spot on. I was way more down for that game after having seen that trailer than I ever was before.
Do you think, I'm just saying this and hoping that it's true, they've got Carl Pilkington in there? I'm just thinking entire tone is like, oh, heroes are a bit full of themselves, aren't they? That would easily work for him.
I'll tell you who they absolutely will have, and he's in Final Fantasy 16.
Oh, the Finchie.
Finchie from The Office, who's in all of those fantasy games. He's in The Witch, he's in The Green Knight, he's in, if you have like a high fantasy,
he's about to be
game,
in Final Fantasy 16 as well.
That's what I mean. And you need a Yorkshireman, you get that guy, I forget.
No one knows his name. I know obviously they do, probably his parents. But like, he's in everything at the minute. Diablo 4, Final Fantasy 16. It's just that dude has an incredibly deep voice.
Is he in Diablo 4
as
well?
He's like the first mage that you meet. He's like this like evil, well, he's not evil, but he's like this like menacing, mysterious type dude who helps you out. But I don't trust him.
No.
I don't trust him very well. Because for now, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
To be heard by all of you, I didn't do an introduction, but I will do an outro.
That is true, you didn't.
Bye.